Welcome back to the CSP Elite Baseball Development Podcast. I'm your host, Eric Cressy, and this is episode 190. I'm really excited to share this episode with you because honestly, it's one of my favorite episodes that I've ever recorded. I find myself, as we are chatting, just scribbling notes off to the side because it wasn't just stuff that I thought would make great content for our listeners, but it was also a lot of actionable items that I think can help me in my daily work, whether it's as a parent, as a coach, as a business owner, you name it. So really, really good information. This guy has an awesome collection of experiences in and around professional sports, not just with athletes, but also with executives, coaches. So I think he brings a wealth of information that's going to benefit just about everybody listening. This episode is brought to you by AG1, the most comprehensive NSF certified for sport daily nutritional supplement I've ever tried. With so many stressors in life, it can be difficult to maintain effective nutritional habits and give our bodies the nutrients they need to thrive. As a father of three young kids and a co-founder of multiple businesses in multiple states, on top of still being an avid exerciser, I know that busy schedules can really take their toll on us. Whether it's poor sleep, exercise or life stressors, environmental factors, or simply not eating enough of the right foods, we can often wind up deficient nutritionally. This is where AG1 can really help. It's a game-changing nutritional insurance policy. They simplify the logistics of getting optimal nutrition on a daily basis by giving you just one thing with all the best things. That's why I use it daily, as do several of my family members, and we recommend it to a lot of our top athletes. One scoop of AG1 contains 75 vitamins, minerals, and whole food sourced ingredients that work together to fill the nutritional gaps in your diet to support energy, focus, digestion, and recovery. And this can all happen for less than $3 per day and without taking multiple products. While most nutritional supplements come to market and stay stagnant, AG1 continues to obsessively improve this one holistic formula based on the latest research, producing over 50 improvements in the last decade alone. They invest in the most absorbable and natural source of each ingredient and go above and beyond in third-party testing to ensure their customers continue to receive the highest quality and best-tasting nutrition habit on the planet. Whether you're keto, paleo, vegan, dairy-free, or gluten-free, it'll work for you, and it contains less than 1 gram of sugar per serving. They put 75 ingredients through the rigorous NSF certification test to come up with a safe formula that's trusted by some of the world's top athletes, including many of our own at Cressy Sports Performance. Right now, AG1 is giving our listeners a special offer of 10 free travel packets with their first purchase. Just head to drinkag1.com/Cressy and claim this special offer. These travel packets are perfect for supporting your immune system, energy, and gut health while you're traveling for games, training, or simply on the go. They can be great counterbalance to the less than ideal on the road food options that are out there for a lot of our traveling baseball players. So if you want to bridge the gap between deficient and optimal and give yourself the best chance of getting nutrient diversity, head to drinkag1.com/Cressy to get 10 free travel packets with your first purchase. Again, that's drinkag1.com/Cressy, C-R-E-S-S-E-Y. You won't regret it. Today's guest is a process and development specialist serving as an advisor to elite athletes, coaches, and executives across professional sports. His current and previous clients include the Tampa Bay Rays, Cleveland Browns, Google, the U.S. Army, Special Operations Command, IMG Academy, the Toronto Maple Leafs, the U.S. Olympic Team, PGA/LPGA, ATP, and the WWE. He was also the mental performance coordinator for the Boston Red Sox when they won the 2018 World Series. He's the author of 2 books, Parent Pep Talks and Mentally Tough Teens, and hosts 2 podcasts, Increase Your Impact and Digging Deep. He's currently pursuing a PhD in organizational behavior and already holds a master's degree in performance psychology. He received his bachelor's degree in communication. He resides in Bradenton with his wife and their 3 children. Please welcome to the show, Justin Sua. Justin, man, thanks so much for joining the podcast. I'm really excited for this.
No, I appreciate it. You see, when you sent the message to chat, I was looking forward to it.
This would be great. And, it's cool getting to know you a little bit through Saratelli and Hosmer. I stalked you on the internet, like you often do prior to having folks on the podcast. And, you know, you've taken a different perspective on this entire, industry, if there's maybe a better term I can come up with, but maybe the good place to start would be to talk about your path to where you are in this world of process and development coaching.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really good point. My personality, I think, who was it? Kurt Lewin, famous, renowned psychologist, says behavior is a function of environment times personality. Mm-hmm. And I think if you go back, I'm not one of those guys that go back and let's dissect my upbringing. But Let's go dissect my upbringing. My parents are very eclectic. I have an immigrant father from the island of American Samoa and a Polynesian island. I have a Mexican American mother, and she didn't graduate high school. My father didn't graduate college, but yet they go to build these multi-million dollar business. My father played professional baseball with the Dodgers and Brewers. He was in the movie business. My mom was vice president of a company, and so I was raised in a family where with parents who literally said, "Shoot for the moon, swing for the fences, and go for it. This is America, and do whatever and follow your curiosity." Essentially speaking, and so I got my bachelor's degree in broadcasting. I thought I was going to be a sports broadcaster, the next Stuart Scott. And then that quickly pivoted to being a high school teacher. And I was a high school teacher. I thought I was going to do that for the rest of my life. I loved it. I loved the youth. I enjoyed making these, I enjoyed designing curriculum. I enjoyed kinesthetic learning. I enjoyed education pedagogy. And then I pivoted, got a master's in performance psychology, fell in love with that. Then I started focusing on parents, helping parents teach the mental game to their kids. I loved it. Thought I was going to do that for the rest of my life. Then I went into the military, started working with soldiers and combat medics and military intelligence and wounded warriors. In the army, it's called warriors in transition. And that's where I fell in love with the rehab process. I fell in love with the psychology of learning and learning design and cognitive functioning. Then I went to the IMG Academy, where I was the head of IMG over there, and fell in love once again with youth sports and teaching mental skills coaches how to teach. And then Boston Red Sox, and then Cleveland Browns, Tampa Bay Rays, and here we are. So it's been quite the road. Learned a lot, and started to develop a little bit of a different philosophy, different approach to what I do. And yeah, just kind of it's been quite the journey.
That's fascinating. We talked a little bit about kind of a recalibration, that you've gone through in the way that you approach your career. Maybe it builds on what you just said about having a different approach to the, I don't know if mental skills world is the way to define it, but this world of preparing the athletes for, competition, for practice beyond just the physical side of things. So I'm curious, like, what is this recalibration that you're working through now? Maybe elaborate a little more for our audience on how you've changed and what drove this new perspective.
I love that. I'll start with what drove it. So I learned a lot of different things along the way, and then once I joined the Tampa Bay Rays, for those who are familiar in the industry, the Tampa Bay Rays are someone once said from the outside, they're the Google of professional sports, kind of an innovative, think outside the box. And when I came to the Rays, I was introduced to a number of re the people on the R&D team, the research and development team. And they opened my eyes to probabilistic reasoning, to thinking, to analytics. And they started to question breathing, question visualization, question self-talk, the efficacy of it. And at first, I was thinking to myself, well, you are offending the sacred cows of sports psychology, the things that this industry has been teaching forever. And what they ended up teaching me and showing me, they're saying, "Hey, no, we're not saying these things are bad. We're not saying don't teach these things. We're not saying that they're not useful. We're just saying let's be humble. Let's be more accurate. Let's understand. Let's take a look at the research. Let's take a look at the methodology, the design, the instruments that they use to come to these conclusions, and then realize their limitations. We can't replicate this study. Humans are complex adaptive systems. We can't create this cookie cutter approach, and we can't realistically and honestly say that if you do this, then you're going to be more relaxed. If you do this, then you're going to be more confident." And they introduced me to a number of different people, like Daniel Kahneman, who recently passed, by the way. I like Klein. They introduced me to systems theory and systems thinking, and a lot of different ways to think, not what to think, but how to think and take a look at these problems. And I remember the book, Thinking Fast and Slow. This is where it really hit me. I was reading this book, and there is this research on intuition debate. How can you trust intuition? And essentially, they came down to this: it depends on what you do. So if the task is static, it's reliable, and you can repeat it, then yes, you can trust intuition. If not, then you need to take it with a grain of salt. The example that they gave was firefighters and police officers. Firefighters an experienced firefighter, you can trust your intuition a little bit more because you're fighting fires that are governed by the laws of physics, which mm-hmm. tend to be predictable and linear and binary. Yeah. Now, police officers, on the other hand, yeah. coaches, on the other hand, mental skills coaches, parents, on the other, even us yeah. as parents, when we're dealing with human beings, they are not governed by predictable algorithms, are not binary, it's nonlinear, like I said, yeah. complex adaptive human systems. And so with that, in that stream of thought, you need to be very humble. You need to be able to come at it and say, okay, you know what? I'm not going to deliver a cookie cutter set of if then practices. Let's take a step back. And then instead of focusing on one modality or industry, in this case, sports psychology, let's see what behavioral economics has to say about that. Let's see what decision science has to say about that. Let's see what the field of leadership and let's see what neuroscience is about that. So it's not necessarily stepping away or pointing a finger at sports psych. Absolutely not. What it's saying is to bring in other industries and other streams of thought. Right. So that's number one. The second thing, which is really interesting, in baseball, for example, you want to create clarity for players. You want clarity for coaches. And I started to notice a really interesting pattern. I noticed that coaches who loved the mental game, they were considering themselves mental. I'm a mental coach. Coaches are saying, and I absolutely agree. There are players who would rather take mental skills advice from a player who's been there and done that. Mm-hmm. They'd rather take mental skills advice from a strength and conditioning coach who they trust, from a hitting coach, a pitching coach who they yeah. trust, rather than some person who has the alphabet behind their name and who has no feel, no connection to the players. And so that was interesting to me. I thought, okay, that is interesting. We have people who don't have degrees necessarily.
Yeah.
However, they're very smart and they could teach it better than people who went and got degrees in this field. Another thing I noticed is players were confusing mental performance and mental skills with mental health and mental wellness and clinical psychology. And so that was creating this even riff in some places between the mental skills coach and the mental performance coach. It's like, who teaches what? And it's a little territorial. And I thought, you know what? Let's do this. Let's create some clarity. Here with the Tampa Bay Rays, we ended up creating renaming a new department called Process and Development Group, which basically establishes helping players and coaches create systems and processes around whether it be post-game, pre-game, what's your system to give feedback, what's your system in staff meetings, what's your process around thinking and decision-making. We do that. And we also want to create clarity of this is the mental wellness group. This is the clinical site. This is what they do. And so that's kind of where we're at right now. And it's just more of a different approach to kind of the same thing, but also incorporating other modalities and other industries into the way we work.
Well, I think it's fascinating because historically, obviously professional sports, really any, I guess, larger corporation have these silos, right? Like, you look at you have accounts payable, accounts receivable, you have HR, you have all these different, kind of dynamics. And I think the challenge is like, all right, you're a player with a foot injury, right? That could be a sports medicine challenge. It could be a challenge to the hitting coaches who are trying to find, your best version of your swing. It could be a challenge for the analytics group where, hey, maybe you're uncomfortable facing this pitch since you injured your foot. Hey, it's a challenge for the base running department because they got to make sure you're confident going first to third in a big spot. So you have all these different people that have their perspectives on how much an athlete is detrained, how far away they are from being back to their normal selves. And then you also have obviously the mental skills aspect of it is, I've had this painful foot. I've been a real jerk at home. My wife's mad at me. That might be more clinical. And then you have, mental skills guy, like, hey, I don't trust this foot. Like, how do I know I'm not going to get hurt? Like there's all these different things. And what I love about what you're describing is it takes all that noise away and it makes it athlete centric. Is that basically the play is start with the athlete and build out around them?
You hit the nail on the head. The conversations that we are having we label them performance conversations, meaning we don't want to have a conversation. We don't come with this toolkit of let's solve your problems. These conversations are generative, meaning we're not going to give you the answer. we want to have a conversation that generates answers. And it might not, it might come to, from the athlete, it might come from the coaches. What I think sometimes a problem with some industries, we want to get away from the guru industry. We want to get away from these people coming in and saying, this is how you develop mental toughness. This is how you develop, you have the elite mindset, and literally leverage the experience and expertise of the men, the women, and the players, everyone in the organization. So it's coming and being able to synthesize and being able to pull out it where ideas emerge from these performance-oriented conversations, where we're not going to the back room and people are saying, what's that guy doing? And another thing as well, in baseball in the past, for some people, not everybody, it was a bad thing to be seen talking to Justin. Mm-hmm. Oh, they're talking to Justin, something must be wrong. Oh, they're talking to that mental guy, something must be wrong. And we're trying to say, no, when you see someone talking to us, oh, that must be a performance conversation. That person is trying to generate ideas, and it's a more open, free flowing, out in public, and we're mixing and matching and bringing people in to solve these problems. But yes, to your point, that's exactly that. We're just trying to normalize decision making and bring more people in and make it more open.
I love that you dropped the mental toughness line, which, you know, I'm actually genuinely fascinated where. You know, like over the years, like we have these, you know, these kids that go to college, you know, every, you know, university on the country does the Omaha Challenge like every year. And you see these guys getting woken up. We had a kid that went to a Division I program. And he's treading water in a sweatshirt at like 5 a.m. The whole team was sick for like 2 weeks. Like, I'm genuinely curious, like, how do you define that? Is it something that's truly trainable? And, you know, in an athlete that's into their 20s, is it something that's largely the result of good parenting and good upbringing, like things like that? Obviously, that's a very massive question. So I hope Pandora's works. Like, do you have an overarching thought on what it is, how you defined it, and whether it's, I mean, for me, it's very skill specific. Like, we have people who are absolute disasters off the field that have an uncanny ability to just lock in and have great at bats in big spots. So where's your head at with it?
I love what you said, and I will say a phrase that I learned that I use all the time is to have strong beliefs loosely held. And the answer that I'm going to give right now, if maybe in a year I go back and watch this, I'm like, I reserve the right to disagree with myself, then the future me disagree with what I'm about to say. So in terms of the context of where my answer is coming from, having a lot of experience, both in the military, a lot of experience now working with special forces, with different industries, football, hockey, baseball, elite CrossFit athletes, mental toughness comes up a lot. And based on my experience, conversations, and just what I've noticed, that term mental toughness, you're right, it is thrown around and people just think it's grit and grime and tough. And my eyes were open when I was in Coronado for a meeting one time, and there was a military, a Navy SEAL leader who he wanted to redefine mental toughness. And I can't stop thinking about this. I think about this actually all the time. This was over a decade ago when he said this. He said he wanted to change the word mental toughness to mental flexibility. And the story that he gave is a soldier. When you think toughness, you think rigid, you think unbreakable, you think hard, which in some cases, in some industry, in some people that really resonates. What he was saying is the most mentally tough people are opposite of that. They are flexible, they're rigid, they adapt. And so sometimes when you have this hard mentality, you just keep pushing and pushing and pushing, as opposed to thinking, you know what, let me change my approach. It doesn't take this. He says sometimes we get so rigid in our thinking and we think toughness is just grimy and stick-to-itiveness. I think I just butchered that word. But mental toughness is really the ability to step back, assess the situation, and to have this flexibility and adapt and adjust. Know when you need to lead, know when you need to step back. And some people completely disagree with that, which is completely okay. What I would suggest is for anyone who's building a mental toughness program is to pause and to ask themselves, okay, what are the trade-offs? What is this worth it for all people? That's the only thing I always ask is whenever you create a system that multiple people are doing, to pause and to ask yourself, to tell yourself, this might not work for everybody. Mm-hmm. And so what is mental toughness for this person? What does it look like in this situation? What does it look like in this situation? I love the nuanced, get into the weeds of everyone's individual situation. And then to be able to say, you know what, this treading water, for some people, it might work. It might build unity. But for other people, the near far transfer, this does not transfer. Yeah, they can swim, but the guy can't hit a curveball. Or the guy, we can use this time for other things, doing other things. And so, yeah, I'm kind of going all around with this answer, but I would just say, whoever's thinking about mental toughness, to really break it down and say, what does that mean for you? Mm-hmm. How do we design it? And how do we measure if it is leading to mental toughness or not?
Yeah. It's so, you know, it seems like it's so much more about, do you have strategies for overcoming, more than can I make you tired and you can put up with it? That's fascinating to me. Like when I see these things and it's just like push a sled until your quads are on fire and you're throwing up, like that doesn't necessarily change a lot, particularly when all 25 guys on the team can accomplish it. You know, it's much more fascinating to me when it's something that like, they've got to communicate, they've got to work together to like, to effectively overcome something that seems like a daunting challenge. So it's a very interesting way of looking at it.
And to your point too, I think as well, we'll get so hung up on certain words, like toughness, for example. I think toughness is necessary, but it's not sufficient. Yeah. Confidence is necessary, but not sufficient. Focus is necessary, but not sufficient for elite performance. And so I think we get on these horses and we just pound this one element in and we think, and then you have these Twitter debates and these long conversations. At the end of the day, you're like, okay, toughness is just one element of it. Then there's this and this and this and this and this. And so I think it's important as well that we don't just get stuck on this one, beat a dead horse, so to speak, and just debate something that is necessary, but is not sufficient. There's so many other things to be talking about, whether as opposed to what is the definition of toughness, and just people just get all up in arms about things like this.
Yeah. But I think it all comes back to like, you know, how do we develop people? You know, how do we prepare them for whatever's ahead, whether toughness is the right word or not, is what we're doing a valuable initiative on the path to them being prepared for whatever the endeavors are. Right. You said it right outright is that confidence is a huge part of this, right? It's one critical piece in this entire initiative. I think we both agree confidence is a moving target, right? Everybody's confident when they're 7 for their last 10, not a whole lot of people are confident when they're 0 for 12 on a weekend series. So, you know, how do we bulletproof it? How do we make sure that people don't go through these highs and the lows so that they can not be overly confident, but at the same time, not be so fragile that even the you know, miniest of setbacks puts them in a tailspin?
I love that question. I love this topic too, because I think you're absolutely right. Confidence needs to be calibrated. You just look at the research on behavioral economics on overconfidence and how it can lead someone to not train, to not practice, to not study, to not work hard because, yeah, I got this. And you just let your guard down. And then there's that lack of confidence, obviously, on the other end of the spectrum. Confidence is a very interesting topic as well, because we talk about it all the time in Major League Baseball, and you hear it all the time. So the question I always ask players is, has there ever been a time where you lacked confidence? You had no confidence facing a Gerrit Cole. You had no confidence facing a Mookie Betts. You had no confidence facing a certain team, but you shoved, but you got two hits, two knocks off the guy. And the player's like, yeah, there've been many moments where I didn't have confidence and I did perform really well. Now, how about this? Has there been a moment where you had confidence and you didn't perform well? And they say, absolutely, absolutely. And then I say, okay, so what does that teach us about confidence? And essentially it comes down to, confidence is great to have, but it is not an accurate predictor of future success or failure for that matter. And so I think that's a key principle to keep in our back pockets when we are talking about confidence. Whatever people's level of confidence is, just understand, it is not an accurate barometer or it can't accurately forecast how you are going to do. So, okay, let's take that and put that on the side. Let's keep that in mind. Now, we all know we'd rather have it than not have it. And when I'm working with high school kids or with parents, I do share a framework, a 5 P's framework about confidence. And so the first one, you mentioned it, present performance. Play good, feel good. play bad, tend to feel bad. Human nature, it's going to happen. The second P is past performance. So what we know about the brain is that if it's vivid enough in your mind, your body will follow. The example I always use is dreams. Take a little child who's having a bad dream, heart rate's going, might be crying, might be moving around, only to wake up and realize, oh, it was just a dream. But the physiological response was responding as if it was real. We can take that phenomenon and we can leverage that for our confidence. With a lot of our players who might be scuffling in the present, this is where we make videos for them of the past. We have them remember moments where they did well in the past, not because it's going to build their confidence, but to get them to go back and remember where the mind goes, the body flows. Get them to remember, you know, I can hit, I can deal, I can, I've had a lot of success before. I've had a lot of moments where I've overcome slumps or scuffles before and in the past. I can do this, past performance. Next one is preparation. The mind, you can't fool the mind. If you didn't put in the work, you're going to be standing on the mound at Yankee Stadium or in Fenway or Dodger Stadium, and your mind's going to say, yeah, you didn't put in the work this week. Yep, you didn't do what you needed. You can't fake yourself out. And so the level of preparation is incredibly, it builds that confidence. Next one, I like to use productive thoughts. There's a major leaguer once who told me, I used to say positive thought, and he's like, I don't like the word positive. It sounds, oh, positive. He goes, yeah. And so we change it to productive thoughts.
Yeah.
Thoughts that get you to focus, that will hone your focus on to the things you can control. Building a system, building a process around, where am I pointing my attention? What thoughts do I want to have? Literally write them down.
Yeah.
And then the next P we talk about, we say positive people. We call them your fountains. Who are you around? When I sit with young athletes, a lot of times their self-talk are the words mom and dad has told them throughout their life. I can't tell you how many youth have told me, oh, I suck at this, or I'm terrible at this, or I'm so bad, I'm never going to do this. I'm like, where is this coming from? And they say, oh, my dad always tells me that. My mom always tells me that. And I have to talk to mom and dad. I'm like, hey, the words you always tell your child, just so you know, becomes their self-talk. And so as a major leaguer, we tell them, hey, the music you listen to, the podcasts you listen to, the people you're around, build those fountains to help you with your confidence. And then last but not least, the last P is purpose. When you know why you do what you do, you have more power to do it. And the most confident people, the most dogged people, they have a why behind what they do. They know why they're doing it. They have a purpose to this workout, a purpose to this bullpen, a purpose to this cage session, a purpose to this at bat. And not that it eliminates fear, because we're human, it cuts through the noise and cuts through the fear and turns down the volume so that you could focus on what you can control. The last thing I will say about confidence is my favorite proverb, Russian proverb, is a bird could rest peacefully on a branch, not because of its trust or confidence in the branch, but because of its confidence in its ability to fly. And I think a lot of problems with confidence is that it's misplaced. And rather than, instead of having confidence on, yes, our ability to do something, yes, and we should have our ability, a confidence in our ability to figure it out if it's not there, or to compete, even if we don't feel right, if the body just doesn't feel good, I have confidence that, you know what, I have my C game, but I'm still going to battle today.
You know, what I love about that is, it was a chance, like in my brain, as you're talking, I'm unifying this with two other things that I saw. So one, Trevor Millard was an awesome guest, God rest his soul, on a previous podcast. And he talked about, you don't have to be unconditionally positive. In fact, it's probably advantageous if you're not. Just don't go negative. You know, he talked about, like the likelihood of you saying you're going to have a terrible day if you listen to like 3 minutes of news in the morning is sky high. And actually, Barbara Corcoran, the real estate mogul, was recently on Tim Ferriss's podcast. And the quote that jumped out at me was, she said, complainers are thieves. You know, they steal your time, they steal your energy, they take so much away from you. It's like, and that last point was, talked about the fountains, was so much like, you can catch yourself when you're about to have negativity in your self-talk and the words you speak, but you have to really, really be mindful about the people that crawl into your world, whether it's the TV you turn on or who you seek out in the clubhouse, or, even who you have in your roster construction, who you hire for staff. Like, in an indirect way, it's just like, don't go negative. Like, that's the most important thing.
I love that. And that is so true. And there's a little activity and if there's, it's funny because there's an activity that I'll do with the team. We did this with the Rays, I think my first season. So I had everybody team up with a partner and I said, okay, we're going to do something that you're all really, really good at. We're going to debate. And you see the guys are go, all right, we're going to debate. You're going to debate against your partner. And I gave them silly examples, or silly topics, hot weather versus cold weather. Go. Watching a movie at home versus in the theater. Go. And they just had these different topics. I only gave them 30 seconds total per topic. And I said, the only goal is win. And you could imagine it went crazy. Guys are yelling at each other. Guys, I said, getting physical, covering each other's mouths. But then at the end, I said, okay, who won? Every hand goes up. Obviously, these are Major League Baseball players, super competitive. And I said, okay, I only want to talk to winners. How did you win? And one guy goes, I didn't let the guy talk. Another guy goes, I listened to what he said, and then I poked holes in his reasoning. Another guy said, I just yelled. I was just louder than him. And then came the point to what you just said. The point is, how is it that we can debate, use these strategies to debate silly topics like this, but we don't use these same tactics to debate our own negative thinking? And then it's like, oh my gosh, yes, you're going to have these thoughts come in. You have these negativity, but instead of absorbing it and taking it to be true, you can talk back to it.
Yeah.
You could poke holes in it. You can debate it. You can turn the volume up. You could ignore it. All these different strategies, processes, systems, things that we sometimes don't even think about. And that's part of the process and development work we do, is say, what's your process around negative thinking? And then guys are like, oh my gosh, I don't have one. Okay, let's design one. And so that's, yeah.
To your point, you're doing it in the first place.
Yes.
That's part of it. It's funny when you just listed like kind of the key takeaway from that, my head was going to like the Dale Carnegie, the best way to win an argument is to avoid it altogether. Like, hey, why are we arguing over movies at the theater versus movie at home? Like, is this worth it? Because let's be real, that's a real thing. You know, Major League Baseball is probably the most politically divided, you know, clubhouse you could possibly imagine. You know what I mean? They have a lot of different, you know, ethnicities. You have a lot of different, home countries, geographic backgrounds within the U.S. It's a very, you know, kind of polarizing place that, you know, has spilled over onto social media and a lot of different things. Like sometimes you just don't go there is the best strategy for avoiding negativity.
That is a great point.
So, you know, I have a lot of very hackneyed, what our staff affectionately refers to as Cressyisms. They get eye rolls whenever I drop them around the facility. But one that I always seem to find myself saying is, you know, you've got to fail forward, you know? And so when you fail, you don't want to dwell on it. You don't want to get stuck in it, but you also don't want to move past it so quickly that you don't learn lessons to improve subsequent outcomes. So I'm curious, what are some strategies in your mind that you've employed, you know, with athletes who have gone through those struggles and come out better on the other side? How do we make sure our failures lead to better outcomes?
Yeah, I am actually fascinated with what that Cressyism. I love that. I have actually a question for you, if that's okay. Yeah. If one of your employees or an athlete comes up to you and says, "Fail forward," and they come up to you and they say, "How? Great. How? What would you say?"
If they ask me, "How can I make the most of this setback?"
So fail forward, and they're and they literally say, "Great, yes, I want to fail forward. How do I do that?"
I think for me, and maybe I'm biased because we've been talking about processes, I think you scrutinize what you did going into it. Like, was there a rationale for you failing? Right? Did you read the scouting reports? Did you get plenty of sleep the night before? How was your pregame prep? Like, if someone comes in and pulls a hamstring, and then you find out that, you know, they slept 2 hours the night before, got hammered, and haven't done a warm up in 2 months. Like, hey, there's probably a pretty good rationale why you wound up in that place. And sometimes that leads to a hard conversation that maybe you couldn't have with an athlete as easily before, but because they're maybe in a little bit more of a vulnerable state, you have to say, hey, man, you know, you're reaping what you sowed. So I think that's, for me, is it leads to a collective, like, go back and let's look at the processes and take emotion out of it.
You remind me. So there's a gentleman, Eduardo Salas. He is a team effectiveness researcher. He's working with NASA to help develop the team that's going to be going to Mars. I think they're competing against I think it's a race to Mars between them and Elon Musk and his crew. But he said something in an interview that I loved when it comes down to somebody kind of put him in a corner and they asked him, they said, what is one thing and one thing only that will enhance team development and team effectiveness and where you can, that these teams can learn faster and be better? You only get one. And he didn't even pause. He came, just came freely out of his mouth. He goes, the debrief. Mm-hmm. You have to pause and reflect on what just happened. He goes, that's the only way to learn. That's the one thing that I would say. He goes, if I were to go around and just tell teams, how do you want to enhance effectiveness? How do you want to enhance learning? Debrief and reflect on what just happened. What you just described is exactly just that. How do you fail forward? How do you use failure as a stepping stool and not a stumbling block? How do you fail fast? You pause. And as Kobe says, you stare your failures in the face. Yeah. You got to look at them. And I think one thing I will say is I don't want to say it's cliche necessarily, but it's getting a lot of traction. We're fail forward, fail fast, like learn from failure, failing, like fail, fail, fail. And it's great. But we also have to remember how hard failing is and how embarrassing it is and how painful it is. And it is, like, you've probably seen so many major leaguers devastated by failure and embarrassed. And I have as well, like in big moments, and their family gets it. And so there's that part to it as well. So to answer your question, I would do just that. I would encourage the athlete to sit and to create a system of questions that they can ask themselves to be able to learn from what just happened. And basically, what questions as simple as, what did I learn from this? What were things that were inside of my control that contributed to the outcome? What were things that are outside of my control that contributed to the outcome? What were some things that I could work on next to get better next time? These questions that will cause us to really look back and then have a plan moving forward. Yeah. And I really believe that we're going to make mistakes, especially at the tippity top of the Major League Baseball. You're competing against the best in the world. And making new mistakes is making progress in disguise. I really believe that. You're going to make new mistakes along the way. Now, in addition to that, I've said this before, and some people may disagree with what I'm about to say, but there's a phrase out there that we talk about learning from failure a lot. What we don't talk about a lot is learning from success. There's that phrase out there, sometimes you win, sometimes you learn. I always say I don't like that because it suggests that you don't learn from success.
Yeah.
It suggests a lot of times you'll win, come in, celebrate. Okay, let's move on, boys. Let's go on. As opposed to pausing and reflecting with the same set of questions that you did when you lose.
Yeah.
Just so you can start to program and systematize the outcome. So you can say, okay, what did I do? What was in my control that led to that win? What was outside of my control that led to that win? What did I learn from the win? And so as you begin to systematize both wins and losses in the debrief process, you are going to continue to be a learning machine. But these are some of the things. And then you come down to timing. Sometimes people are so, I was talking to a coach one time and he wanted to debrief with a player right after a game. And my suggestion was, don't do that. Like, mom and dad, the time when you're in the car right on the way home, when the player is in the red, that's not the ideal teaching time. Their emotions are hot. The amygdala is going. They're not listening. They're not rational. You can yell. You can scream. You can be mad at them. It's anyone that you got to find the proper timing. And then that's different for everybody.
That's a great point. You know, the other thing I think on failures is I think it's a very important differentiation when it's a one-time thing versus it's a recurrent thing. You know, like I've always been on the mindset, if I have a staff member that doesn't live up to an expectation we set for them, you know, the first time it's my fault, you know, for not relating that better, for teaching you better, starts happening again, then it's your fault. So we had a staff member one time, I'll never forget it. We trained a group of firefighters for our local, city. We have a great relationship with them. And so we'll get, 16 to 20 firefighter recruits for 10 weeks of 7 to 7:45 AM training. And there was a Friday where we had a staff member that had recently gotten over being sick and just slept through an alarm, like was supposed to be there at 7 AM. And we're talking about firefighters. These are the most punctual. I mean, this is basically a military operation. And there were 16 of them waiting at the door and we didn't have a coach there, at 6:50 to open the door for them. So, it was one of those like staff member was absolutely mortified. And that person has been an absolute star for us ever since. It's never happened again. It was an apology and all this stuff, but if that happens 3 times in 3 weeks, then we have a huge problem. Like that's something I can't teach you to wake up on time. But if you're sick as a dog and you literally slept through an alarm that was beeping right next to you, that's telling me you're actually probably really sick. And it wasn't the right fit for you to be there. So I always try to separate bad processes from bad outcomes. Cause the last thing you want to do is really just scold something that was a bad outcome when in reality, everything that led up to it was actually pretty solid.
I love that you said that. And I think that is one of my pound the pulpit things as well, is separating that process from the outcome. Yeah. I think there is a huge differentiation between the two, to exactly to your point. I think sometimes we will, the example that somebody once gave me is if you run a red light and you pass through unscathed, like you don't get hit, some people, that wasn't a good decision. It was luck. It was good luck. But if you start, let's say it's a green light and you decide, you know what? I'm not going to go on the green light. Nope. Green light's not going to tell me what to do. And then a car comes barreling through and you would have been hit if you would have gone through the green light. That wasn't necessarily a good decision. That was good luck. That was just dumb luck that happened. And so to your point, I think it's very important to not mistake the outcome with the process and say, hey, you might have a great process. Outcome wasn't good. You might have a terrible process and outcome was great. And I love that you said that. And it also reminded me, there's a book called Think Twice by Michael Malbison. And Michael Malbison gives this example of working, Daniel Kahneman working with military cadre instructors. And he was suggesting to them that after they make a mistake, Air Force pilots make a mistake, don't yell at them. Like you don't have to yell at them because you're actually going to delay them learning. You're going to trigger them emotionally and it's going to delay them getting better. And then they all get mad at him and they're like, no, it works every single time. And what's funny is when we give them praise, they actually drop performance. And so all he did is he introduced a concept to them, regression to the mean. He goes, these are the tippity top best fighter pilots in the world. When they have a performance that's below the norm, what the regression to the mean states, they're probably the next iteration, they're going to pick it back up. Yeah. And it's not because you yelled at them. It's because they're the best in the world. They've already proved that they're really good. They're going to get back up. Yeah. If they perform really, really well and you chastise them, so to speak, they don't drop performance because you chastise them. They drop performance because they're regressing to the mean. That one data point, that outlier that they perform better, it's like they're going to drop a little bit. And so I think that's great leadership as well, to be able to say, hey, you know what? Rather than jump down this guy's throat, let me assess the person. Okay, they have a track record of being elite. You know what? Hey, they feel bad. Talk about it. Yeah. All right. They're probably never going to do that again.
And that's a slippery slope. Elite is different than outlier. Like, I don't think people recognize that. I came up as a competitive powerlifter, right? We know the difference between a competition max and a training max might be, 10%, where a guy squats 900 in training, but then, he deloads for a week, he gets into a competition in front of, 200 people with loud music and people yelling at him. And all of a sudden he squats 1,000 pounds for the first time. Like, we've seen that time and time again. And the challenges, I think that a lot of the coaches that we see, across all levels of sports they're casual observers to the world of exercise physiology and to the world of, kind of performance psychology, if that's a good way of describing it, is the expectation becomes you're going to PR every single time. Hey, you hit a ball 117, you're going to hit one 118 next week if we're doing a good job. And like, sometimes like all the stars had to align to get that. But what I think we should look at doing is how do we collectively bring up, you know, the 75th to 90th percentile stuff? How does that become more and more common? Like that level of performance so that we're effectively capping the bottom.
They're embedded in your answers. A lot of the answers that you give and what just even just the comment that you just made, I notice a certain pattern that you do, which again, we haven't known each other for a very long time, but it's needless to say that I knew about you before we even met, and I've heard years and years and years ago. It's starting, the more I get to know you, the more I'm noticing one of your traits that I think lead to a lot of your success is the questions, very thought-provoking questions. Instead of this is what we need to do, hey, I wonder how do we do this? What would it take to do this? What would increase the probability of taking this and moving this to here? Those kind of questions to you, it's like, of course you ask those questions. A lot of people don't pause to ask those questions. It's very emphatic and this is what we need to do as opposed to, okay, what needs to be true if we were to increase this group or in order to do this? It's more of the scientist mindset. And I think there's like a lesson in embedded in just the way, even just you're talking right now. And I think that's when you talk to the best in the world, the leaders, they don't have this, Adam Grant talks about, they don't have this evangelist mindset, evangelizing their way. They don't have this prosecutor mindset where they're just poking holes in everyone's thing. They don't have this politic mindset where they're just pandering to the different audiences that they talk to, changing colors with everything. They have more of a scientist approach. And hey, let's explore, let's poke holes in our own assumptions. Let's question how things have been done, and let's find the best way to find the answers according to our situation, not necessarily what the science says. Yes, we want it to be science, data informed and evidence based. But sometimes, in my experience, you can correct me if I'm wrong. At least in social sciences, sometimes the science needs to catch up with the real world. We don't have data on major league coaching staff effectiveness. No one's done that study, and so sometimes the research isn't generalizable to this specific unit and situation. And so you got to take it with a grain of salt.
We interrupt this podcast with a quick reminder that this episode is brought to you by AG1. It's an NSF-certified all-in-one superfood supplement that features 75 whole food-sourced ingredients designed to support your body's nutritional needs. I use this product daily myself, and a ton of our athletes do as well. Head to drinkag1.com/Cressy and claim my special offer of 10 free travel packets with your first purchase. AG1 gives you peace of mind that you're covering all your nutritional bases. Again, that's drinkag1.com/Cressy, C-R-E-S-S-E-Y, and you'll get that special offer.
We've thrown the word process around a bunch on this, and certainly the word process is another one of those hackneyed expressions that get tossed around. You know, trust your process. I mean, the first question is, how does an athlete know if their process sucks? And then, question 1A on that is, what goes into actually creating a good process?
Yeah, I think so. A lot of great questions. So how do you create a great process? The first question to understand is what is a process? You can also use the word system. I think I understand, like your email is like, it talks about systems, training systems, yeah. Systems, processes. I think I have a book that I love. The thing that opened my eyes is, I'll just show it right here. So there's thinking systems theory. So this book, Thinking in Systems and Mental Models, you take a look at the research on systems. You want to create systems that are replicable, like things, being able to control the things you can control. So we pause and we take a look at, okay, let's take a look at certain industries who have processes. Doctors have processes. They have checklists. Okay, what do I do before a surgery? Pilots have a process. Right before they take off, they have a checklist. It doesn't matter if you've been flying for a week or you've been flying for 50 years, you're going to do the same process. So usually you have processes in moments where you're probably going to do it. The stakes are high, and you are also vulnerable to bad decision-making, mm-hmm. bad thinking, to letting your emotions get the best of you, not focusing on what you can control. So the first thing, whoever's listening to this, I would ask, okay, where could you need a process? Here are some examples. Maybe a pre-game checklist, right, to get your mind right before a game. Maybe it's a post-game process or system, right, to be able to learn and to be able to digest what just happened. Maybe you have a process on deck to kind of get your mind right. And so I can't tell you how many major leaguers come back to the dugout, having been in the dugout for the past 5 years, 162 plus games, including playoffs. And a player will say, I just gave that bat away. I was not present for that. Or a pitcher saying, I just blanked. I was not locked in for that. Again, it doesn't happen all the time, but you want to create a process that will increase the probability that you will be here now, that your mind is where you want, when you want, on the things that matter most. So you got to identify that. How do you know where that is? Before you can change a system, you need to go back and understand the current patterns of the system. So I would observe the player, or ask mom and dad or the coach to observe the player. And you say, he or she always gets mad here. You got to take a look at the emotions of the person. Where are they getting emotional? Where are they not getting back? Are they losing time getting frustrated? Are they losing time because of their lack of focus? Are there certain elements, things that happen when a guy gives up a walk? He'll get so frustrated. Okay, let's build a process there. So that's number one. Where do you put a process? Number two is, what kind of process do you want? The process needs to be fluid. It needs to be easy. Can't be cumbersome. Mm-hmm. And the process can't be the obstacle itself. There's a player I was working with who was self-proclaimed OCD. He told me, he's very OCD. He's like, I'm OCD. He comes up to me one day, starting pitcher, and he goes, I need a process before every pitch. And I was like, heck no. He's like, wait, what? I was like, you are not going to have a process. He goes, why? I was like, he goes, I want to take a deep breath and I want to do this and tell myself this before every pitch. I said, if I know you, I've known you for years. If you do that, that process is literally going to become the obstacle. Yeah. Your personality is going to be more, you're going to focus more on that than actually executing the pitch.
Can't be analytical, like, oh, and competitive.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly right. So you got to understand the person as well. And so, and then to answer your question, how do you know if your process sucks? There's a couple of elements to that. I'll break that down. So it sucks if the process becomes the obstacle. It sucks if it's so cumbersome that you can't execute it all the time. It sucks if you're just taking something that somebody else does and you're applying it to yourself without considering why they do it or the situation they're doing it in or the personality that they have. I think sometimes we have these elite athletes who say these, and for any industry, anyone who's at the top of their industry, they could philosophize and give these amazing things. And now everybody wants to take it and do it themselves. Hey, this person paid the price to develop this process. You got to find what works for you. That's where you know it sucks. Another element is if there's obviously a lagging effect to the process and the outcomes. So we'll just go your workout process. We can go your hitting process. And how do I know if this process is going to lead to the results that I want? How do I know that? That's where you need outside experts and to leverage the wisdom of crowds. We need to talk to your coach. You need to talk to any experts and say, hey, bring people in and say, hey, let's talk about this together. Yeah. What do you think about this? What do you think, coach? What about this? Who have an understanding? And then together you create this process and then you identify, okay, we have lagging indicators. What are leading indicators? What are indicators that might be short-term where we know we're on the right track? And then the experts the person who's experienced might be able to say, you have to remind the person, hey, we might not see the results until 3, 4, 5 months, but there's a compounding effect. Let's create some moments where we're going to come in and check some data points to see, is the needle trending up or is the arrow trending up? I think there's that phrase, there's that mental model that goes, the map is not the territory. Mm-hmm. So big picture, they might not see the results, but the expert can show them, hey, actually you're trending up in this. So, hey, it's giving us an indication that for right now, the process is good.
I like that. So I'm going to make a really roundabout question here. So, you know, I think we've all interacted with these young athletes that are more mature than their age, right? Like, you know, we've had 12, 13 year olds that come into our facility and they might as well be like college or professional athletes in terms of the attention to detail and the adherence, particularly because like, you know, when you're a smaller guy in the big facility, like you kind of toe the line and follow the rules and all that stuff. And you have others that just aren't ready for it. They're not mature enough. And I have a fascinating social experiment going on that I have, you know, twin daughters that are both 9 and a half right now. And what's fascinating is, you know, we have a blonde and a brunette. We have one that has olive skin like mom and the other one that's pasty white like dad. We have a lefty and a righty. We have one that reads 4 hours a day. She'll be like sitting upside down. The other one that is just like bouncing on the wall and wants to do 50 different activities all the time. So what is fascinating about it is that they both do gymnastics. And one, it's very just kind of like a social, like, what are my friends going to be? And the other one is taking it really seriously. Like she's super into it, which is, you know, I'm thrilled for both of them. But what I'm interested in is when you do get this high motivation, you know, young athlete, A, like what's the age where you test the waters? Because we know kids have processes. You know, we get up, we get ready for school. Like, you know, you got to have breakfast, you got to get dressed. You know, you got to change out of your pajamas before you put your shoes on. There's all these different things they go through. So I'm curious. I have a 9-year-old daughter and she's in the stage of gymnastics where you're rolling and holy crap, that's a triple back handspring. That's really hard to do. And I'm afraid you're going to break your neck. How do we know how to help them take their preparation to the next level without being overbearing? Like, what's a gradual way where I can put my foot in the shallow end to help her develop a good process, but at the same time, not take the fun out of gymnastics and make it overwhelming at this age? Because I think there are a lot of parents that really struggle with this.
I completely agree. And I will say, so I never do what I'm about to do right now. I wrote a book called Parent Pep Talks, meaning, which is kind of a manual of performance psych tools for moms and dads. I never talk about it much. I wrote it 10 years ago and some of the things in it, I've updated my thoughts, my beliefs, but the reason I just shared that is because I told the publisher, I don't want to do it because I don't want to be known as a parent expert. I have three kids myself and I don't know what I'm doing. but to your point, I have three children, not 18, 17, 16, and they're all in the arts. So my son, we have the Billboard Music Award. He's a famous music producer who produces music and he's 18 and he's been doing it for 5 years and he's just killing it. And he has his own business and he was 17 years old. We have a daughter who's the star of her own Disney TV show and was a daughter with a rock in the movies. And so to your point, I'm like, how do we as parents water their ambitions yet at the same time, not make them feel like these are industries that they have to pigeonhole themselves. Yeah. Hey, like, and we don't want them to lose the fun. I could tell you what we do. It might not be right for everything. So these are the things we consider. I don't know if I can accurately say what you should or what parents should do, but here are some things to consider. So the number one thing is the trajectory of youth sports. So they're going to go through three phases. The purists say there's way more than that, but we'll just keep it for three right now. You go the romance stage, the specialization stage, the professional stage. Kids are dropping out of sport. I can't remember the latest research on it. They were dropping out at astronomical rates because what was happening, a lot of parents are forcing kids into the specialization phase when they're still in the romance phase. Now, that's the general population of youth. But what about when you get a daughter like yours? What about when you get a 9-year-old child or an 8-year-old or a 10-year-old and you're watching, you're like, oh my goodness, they love this. And then as they hit that cycle, you love something, you want to do it more. The more you do it, the better you get. The better you get, the more you love it. The more you love it. And all of a sudden, they just start iterating and iterating. And now they're progressing incredibly fast. And so what do you do in that moment? Mm-hmm. So for what we do, understanding our child development, a couple of things. The first thing that we try to do is to help them realize as parents, we love you no matter what. We never wanted to make them think that our love for them, because we have our love for them is tied to the success that they have in their sports, the ribbons that they get, the awards that they get. That was number one for us. We love you no matter what. It's like we are pouring, we as a mom and dad, we talk about things completely different. The second thing that we do is we have a lot of conversations with them. We talk about, especially the ones who love it, they're going to go through very hard times the further along they get. So as a result, my son has had experiences that I didn't have until I was in my 30s. I didn't have until I was in my 20s. Hard conversations with adults, heartbreak on the public world, getting social media attacked as a 15-year-old, as a 17-year-old, having people like smear your name and you're in eighth grade. And so these are ninth grade. And so it was a forcing function to have very open conversations about failure, about adversity, about fear, about nerves, about all of the, and we weren't necessarily giving them tools, but having these conversations. And I think as parents or as coaches, we can normalize that part, because when you go through specialization, it's normal to be nervous. It's normal to have fears. It's normal to fail, especially the better you get. You're going to be trying things that the average person your age doesn't do, and you're going to be scared. Okay, let's teach you breathing. Let's teach you some visualization. Let's help you with those things. And then the last thing that we do is we are constantly kind of, as a last thing is A and B. There was one day my daughter was on set, a big event. It was a big episode. We go back to her trailer. I was stressed watching it. I'm like, how is she doing this? Like, I'm just stressed. I go and I give her a hug and I put my hand, I look in her eyes. I say, sweetheart, you don't have to do this. Do you still want to do this? And she goes, yes, daddy, I love this. I absolutely love this. And so as parents, we just watch her curiosity. We watch what do they do in their free time? Do they truly love it? Are they watching gymnastic videos? Are they practicing gymnastics without even being told? And if that's the case, which is our kids, we'll force them sometimes. Go out with your friends. Go, hey, put that away. Let's go out to a movie with the family. Let's build the holistic person. So those are some of the things as well that we do, especially at such a young age. And we also want to make sure that they're progressing. So we put them, give them access to coaches and people who could take them to the next level and grow. We vet the coaches out as well. So these are all the things that we take into consideration that we are currently trying to do. We are not perfect. We struggle. We worry that they're missing out on being a teenager sometimes, but that's some of the stuff that, and we always have this conversation of you sign up for the hard road the moment you commit to go after your dreams. And we say, if you say you want to do this, like these are the things that are the hard things that are part of the journey that a lot of people don't talk about.
What I like, it almost piggybacks on the conversation earlier about like, you know, trying to bring the middle up is like, really what you described is you're protecting against downside to give them the opportunity to chase upside. You know, it's like the someone who wants to lose weight, the best way to do it is to get the bad food out of the house. Like, don't be tempted. Like, you're really just cutting off the bottom. And so I love that mindset. It's one more reason why you don't have those conversations right after a kid goes 0-for-4 with 3 strikeouts. You know, it's a pensive approach, because otherwise just the proximity of the conversation to the game immediately ties their self-worth to that.
I love that. Can I add one more thing, please? So another thing we add to our kids as well is probabilistic reasoning. Mm-hmm. We talk about probability all the time in our home at the dinner table. And what I mean by that is I will have the kids, our children, put a probability to an outcome happening, something that they really want. So for example, if my daughter does an audition for a big TV show or a big movie or whatever, I will give her, okay, what's the probability that you get it? Early in her young career, she'd be like 99%, 90%. And all of a sudden she'd get this exam. Nope, didn't get it. Nope, didn't get it. Nope, did it. Over and over and over again. And now she's starting to calibrate and say, oh, I'm way off. And now recently she just did an audition for a huge movie. So, and she feels really good about it. Sweetheart, what's the probability that you get it? And she goes, I'd say about 3%. Say, how do you feel? She goes, that's awesome. And it's really neat, because the reason we do this is we wanted to help our kids. I didn't want to correct whatever probability. Even we wanted to help them understand that there's a chance that you get it, but there's a high chance, especially when you want to be the best in the world, that you don't. And the question I ask them, I tell our kids all the time, the probability of you being an A-list celebrity celebrity is less than 1%. The probability of you being one of the best producers in the world, less than 1%. Why are you still doing it? Dad, because I love it. Okay, then let's go. Let's keep going. Okay, as long as you know that the probability is low, but you still love it so much that you can't stop, we can't pay you to stop. All right, let's keep going. And so it has helped us help them calibrate their confidence, not be negative, calibrate and say, yeah, I don't care if the odds are low. Let's go for it. Let's swing for the fences.
I love that. You know, it's funny. My next question, you kind of already answered it with the example of your daughter at that you know, big time scene. But, you know, we all have these athlete interactions that change our career. Like I can count more than I can imagine. You know, I think we'd probably agree that the athletes teach us far more than we can ever teach them. But with that in mind, maybe you could share a transformation story of an athlete interaction that you had that impacted the way that you either manage relationships, drive processes, or maybe shape development in the years that have followed. Is there something that stands out as like a very compelling interaction you had that has changed the course of your career?
Yes. There's been a lot, to your point, a lot. And you're right. Tip of the cap to the athletes who are in the arena. I learn more from them than from they learn from me 100%. There was one in particular in the spirit of youth sports. I'll never forget this experience. A dad reached out to me. He came in with me and his senior baseball playing son. And him and his son sat, we were sitting in front of me. And the dad goes, I would love for you to give my son some thinking tools, some processes around his mental game. And I said, yeah, what do you got? And his son's sitting right there. He goes, I love him. And I see how hard he works. I see how much he cares. I see how much he wants to play baseball at the next level, but his emotions get the best of him. He lacks confidence. I think if he just has some tools, some mental processes and systems, it'll really help him. And then I look at the son and I said, do you have any comments on that? And the son isn't looking at me. He's looking at his dad. And he asks his dad, he goes, are you serious? And the dad goes, yeah, you work so hard. And I think these tools can help you. And I think this is what you really need. And his son goes, no, are you serious that you love me? And the dad goes, what? He goes, I've never heard you say that. Like, I've never heard you say like you love me. Here, I feel so much pressure trying to play well, because I feel if I play well, you're going to love me more. And it's creating so much pressure. And then the dad goes, of course I love you. And he goes, I just want to see you do well. And so I say, you know what? You guys go talk about it and we'll talk later. Needless to say, they never came back. I never saw them again. But the reason this really impacted me forever is because it really helped me to understand that my role is to get out of the way. Yeah. I think a lot of these players will come and they want a say, like some people want a sage on the stage, but the reality is they want a guide on the side. I want to be able to help them create conversations that are generative. I don't want to give the player the ideas. Let's have a performance conversation where the idea emerges. Let's leverage your strengths, your weaknesses, your values, your experiences, so you can find your own answers. I think early in my career, I felt like I had to have the answer. I had to have the tools, the strategy, the knowledge, but to realize, you know, no, like let's, the player's the hero, the coach is the hero. Let's have these conversations to help them so that they can realize I can help them not with what to think, but how to think. And that experience really helped me realize, get out of the way, ask effective questions, and watch the answers start to emerge. And in the spirit of youth athletes, but I have a lot of professional ones as well, but that was the first one that jumped to my mind.
That's fascinating. I mean, literally, you know, the father wants the kid to be successful. And the kid, on the other hand, is literally just, he's defined success, but feels like the goalposts keep getting moved, no matter how well he does or how poorly he does. It's never going to be good. I mean, and I'm sure it happens far too often in, you know, in a number of different fronts, relationships, all that. I think we can both agree that there are a lot of athletes, even at the highest levels, that just want it to be defined to them. What is the outcome I'm chasing? Like, you know, we hear about, you know, guys who are in AA that are like, I think I should be a big leaguer. Why am I not there? And sometimes they have that hard conversation with a front office member or, you know, senior member of the coaching staff who actually can speak to, here's what you need to do better go hit this, you know, objective, and then we'll talk about you being a big leader. But it's very hard when you don't actually know what the tangible end goal is.
That is such a good point. That is such a good point. And another thing, I think collectively that I'm learning from these athletes, I always say this, I wish I can go into a room and have everyone sit in there. These Major League Baseball players who we all know and we all know, love, and we're all in awe of their amazing athletic prowess. But when you, like yourself and like myself, when you have a friendship with them and access to them at the level that we have, you're able to see that they're human just like us. That some days they lack focus too. Some days they question their confidence. Some days they beat up on themselves, and they're able to navigate and get through it. So I think that is inspiring. Where a lot of people are like, "Oh, I'm so bad. I'm so negative." And when they learn that pro athletes are the same as well, and they have to navigate the internal noise and the external noise as well, that's just inspiring to a lot of people. And so that teaches me a lot as well. That hey, you know what? We're all going through it. Even these athletes and these coaches and these executives and these brilliant people who we respect so much, they too are human.
You know, it's funny. I'm even pulling out my phone because I'm looking at, I want to make sure I get the actual name of the book correctly. I believe it was called The Friction Project that I just listened to. And it just talked about like dealing with, you know, confrontation in workplaces, how to have conversations, all that stuff. And there was a term that got thrown out there that I thought was phenomenal. And I don't like to curse, but this is a quote. It said, sometimes the best leaders are umbrellas. They protect the people underneath them from shit, right? So maybe that's like you're a department head and you handle all the budget stuff so that the people underneath you can just do their jobs and be stars. Like you don't want them to know that, you know what, is just raining down on them all day and you're trying to protect them. I think athletes are very, very similar, you know, particularly, you know, in roles like these, where I always, and I never thought about this. I think, you know, there's obviously a transition that a lot of athletes have to make as they become coaches, where you have to go from being inherently selfish to having that servant mentality. And I think that's why former catchers make great managers, utility players make, I mean, you've seen it. I've seen it. Like utility players make great managers as well. You know, career minor leaguers who maybe just get the cup of coffee, they realize how hard it is. I think what we forget is that we all have these MOs. Like we all have these things that we want to push. Like I want a 15 exercise warm up every day that meticulously attacks every element of their movement deficiencies. I want it 162 games plus spring training plus postseason. And you try to race to the front. What you don't realize is maybe there's 7 other members of the coaching staff that are racing the front. Maybe there's an angry significant other and 3 kids that want to move to the front. Maybe they're providing for their family. And maybe it's a guy from the Dominican Republic who got a good signing bonus. He doesn't realize that we don't know that everybody in his hometown is hoping that he can financially support them. There's all these different factors that contribute to it. And I always try to think about, like, in this moment, am I helping or am I interfering? Like, am I part of the solution or am I just adding to the problem? And there are times I think we can both recognize that the best thing we can do is like, hey, what can I take off your plate right now? How can I make this easier for you? How can we, and you don't want to pave the path for them. You know, that's the problem with not the helicopter parents, the snowplow parents that make everything easier. But sometimes at the highest levels, it's helping them to figure out like, hey, what's the solution? You know, how do we narrow the focus so that you can just work on the things? Hey, we're going to cut the warm up in half today. You know, we're just going to make this easier. You know, I'll grab you to take the guesswork out of it. We'll go through 4 things and you go hit in the cage and you're good to go. So I've always tried to be like, how can I be part of the solution and not just part of the problem? But you have to really be able to step back in the moment and recognize like, I'm not the most important part of this process. It's hard.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
I love that. I'm going to use that quote. I need to get that book. That sounds that is so true. Yeah. And I bet there's been moments in your career where you have a one-on-one, you have a training session with a player, and as they're going through dynamic warm-up, wherever it may be, he starts talking and sharing something that's on his mind. And I don't know for sure. I'm just making this up. Maybe you're like, you notice in the moment, you know what, this conversation is probably more important than the workout itself. Yeah. You know what? I don't know if that's the case, but it's over. And you're like, he just needed someone to talk to in this moment. And it's not in this moment. It doesn't happen all the time, but I feel the exact same way.
It goes both ways. I had an athlete one year walk in and said, I think I'm getting a divorce, with tears in his eyes. And And, you know, we had a 5 minutes conversation, and the best thing for him was to go throw med balls as hard as he could against the wall.
Yes.
We left in a better place. You have to read the room a little bit, but I think if there's one thing that's probably gotten better over the years is my empathy, like, you know, having conversations with Cuban athletes and realizing what they had to go through to even come and live this dream in the US. It's changed my perspective pretty dramatically on, you know, what we take for granted and, you know, how we can best support these guys. Sometimes it's not just the X's and O's in the training program. It's much more, you know, helping on the social side of things or whatever it may be.
It's what you are saying is my next fascination. This topic is what I love. I just went to join an NHL coaching staff, and the conversation that they wanted to bring me in to have was, how do you build relationships so strong they can bear the weight of truth? That was the whole topic. How do you build relationships? Get to know them, asking questions. And like you and me, it's like, okay, this is almost intuitive. Of course, you're going to find out about their family, the incentives, their purpose, their why. Like, but for a lot of people, you're 100%, like, this is mind blowing to them. It's like they have to avoid the advice trap. Instead of just giving advice, it's like, wait, let me pause. Let me ask a well-timed, effective question rather than tell them what to do. Let me pull out rather than pour in. And some people really need to learn how to do that.
And you know what I'll tell you is, the fact that you had that conversation with an NHL coaching staff tells you that it's important across all sports, because collectively people genuinely agree the NHL athletes on the whole are the most mature of the four professional sports. They're the most grounded because the compensation tends to be lower. It's the longest, like nobody, you know, a lot of them go to junior hockey and all stuff. They generally are more mature by the time they arrive there. So, you know, they're just a very pensive group. So for a coaching staff to be like, hey, I'm having a hard time having these hard conversations with grown adults that are very mature, you know, there's very little language barrier in that world. It's just a fascinating thing that we all need to really be mindful of as, you know, coaches, performance assistants, whatever, you know, we want to refer to ourselves as. These are critical things that we have to hit on.
It's a great point.
So we've hit on a bunch of topics. I always round up with a lightning round. And I'm actually really fascinated because I'm a pretty voracious reader, and I know you are as well. What's a book that you recommend to a lot of athletes and a book that you recommend to a lot of coaches? Because I know nowadays you're coaching the coaches as much as you are the end consumers.
Yeah. So I think the first question to athletes. So whenever I love reading so much, and I'm such a advocate for reading, whenever someone says, what good book recommendation do you have? I will always answer the question with a question. Yeah. What was the last best book you read?
Yeah.
Just so I can see what type of reader they are. Yeah. And whatever they say, okay, boom, 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 boom. Yeah. I'll just go, whatever. I won't suggest something heavy for someone who's but I would say, to answer your question, the most common one that I'd recommend is any of the Ryan Holiday Stoic books for the athletes, I think those are, the reason is, they don't like to read a lot, generally speaking. And so it's got to be quick, to the point, pithy stories, and have a purpose that they can tie to baseball, to tie to their sport. I tend to get really good feedback, whether it be ego is an enemy, obstacle is the way, those common ones for the athlete themselves. They can read them in the planes, like things like that.
I think he just came out with a parenting book as well.
I
haven't checked it out yet, but I literally just saw it in my Audible recommendations.
Yes, absolutely. Now for the coaches, I'm the exact same. Mm-hmm. But I think for the coaches, particularly, you hit the nail on the head. There's a certain group of coaches that I love to work with, are the former players just moving into a special assistant role, or a player moving into a coaching role. I was talking to a person, an NFL executive, and he said, we are putting hundreds of millions of dollars into players. We should be putting way more resources into the coaches, because if you're a coach, you're either a coach because you knew the head coach or the manager, you knew somebody, or you were just really good at the sport and it just kind of flowed right in. And also, you're a good teammate, you're good at it, but you didn't get performance psychology. You don't have a degree in performance psychology. You don't have a degree in education pedagogy. They don't have the business degrees, a lot of these things that they need to be an effective coach. And so that is such a fun group. If I'm a coach, what I would recommend is to start off, like, you've probably read all these. So Shane Parrish has these books, The Great Mental Models. So he has three volumes right now, The Great Mental Models. Any books that will force you to upscale your thinking, how to think. So books like The Great Mental Models by Shane Parrish, books like Super Forecasting, Tetlock, books like Think Again by Adam Grant, that just causes you to question your own assumptions and have strong beliefs loosely held. Tetlock even goes on to say that beliefs are hypotheses to be tested, not treasures to be guarded. And so I think if you're a coach, you need to really learn how to test your own assumptions to be able to help the player the best.
I love that. You know, and one that I'm really fascinated about is, like, I remember listening to a podcast, like the number one predictor of happiness is focus. Like, to know that you're actually trending in the direction of getting to where you want to be. And we've all had those days where you're like, you know, sick kids at home, you've got to do a call with an athlete, there's noise in the background, you're trying to write a book, you know, you got to race to the park, whatever it is. And you get to the end of the day, I'm like, man, I was up for 15 hours and I don't feel like I accomplished anything. And those are the days that drive you bonkers. And then you stay up all night thinking about all the things you would have done differently. I think a lot of young athletes just have 1,000 things going on in their brain all the time. What do you think the biggest distraction is for young athletes? And are there any broad, you know, strokes that you can paint on how they can best deal with these things?
Yeah, I think when you say young athletes, these are all athletes who are, a lot of them have to operate within the system of, like, obviously mom and dad and their beliefs. They have their family, have so many things going on. I would say start by building systems and processes around three finite resources: your time, your energy, and your attention, or your focus, to your point. What I would do to suggest, I would start with, if I would, one advice is create a win the morning routine. And this, there's so many things we can, directions we can go, but I want to stay very universal and generalize this because we could all do this. We each have 86,400 seconds a day. My suggestion would be, when you wake up in the morning, instead of having the day run you, you need to learn to run the day. And so it could be, when the morning is a routine that you do every single morning that gets you set up for success. I don't care if you're in eighth grade. I don't care if you're a senior. You can be in college. You could be a major league all-star. But when the morning, I'll tell you what it's not. It's not necessarily waking up at 3 o'clock in the morning and grinding and taking a picture of your watch and showing everyone, I'm up at 2, where are you at? Like, it's not that. I'm all for optimizing the physio fundamentals, sleep, exercise, and nutrition, Yeah. Obviously. So get your sleep. And then when you wake up, what's the first thing for the first 30 minutes, hour of your day, whatever you can, what are you going to do? Maybe it's for the spiritual kids, it's going to read their Bible. Maybe some people meditate. Maybe it's some kids, they read a book. Maybe some kids, they do pushups. Maybe some kids, they go for a run. Maybe it's journaling, and maybe it's writing down what you're going to accomplish this day. It could be 15 minutes. It could be 30 minutes. It could be 90 minutes, but winning the morning. And when you do that every single day, you start to train your brain to say, you know what? I'm taking control of this brand new day, and it's going to evolve, and you want it to be something you can do during the winter, during the summer, on vacation, something to kind of get you in the habit of going. That's a simple low-hanging fruit general suggestion that I have for young athletes and even adults.
I love that. So you've teased our clients, our audience, all these folks with amazing stuff right now. Like, my brain's running a little bit. Like, I feel like I'm maintaining eye contact while I want to scribble notes the entire time about how this stuff applies to what I do on a daily basis. And, you know, probably the best place to go from here is, I know you've got some really cool new things, Brian. I know you have a wildly successful podcast that's been around way longer than mine, but I'm curious, you know, from your words, what's up next for you, and how can the listeners learn more about you?
Awesome. Thank you for this opportunity. So the first one, the Increase Your Impact podcast, it's a podcast for moms and dads and kids. Early in my career, when I was with the Red Sox, I would get inundated with parents, work with my child. And I want to, but I can't, don't have the time. And so, you know what, let me set up a podcast, 2 to 3 minutes per episode. And let's just send it out. The things that I'm using with big leaguers, let's give them to kids, and it's all there for free. So that's called the Increase Your Impact podcast. You've been on our new podcast with Eric Hosmer. It's called Digging Deep podcast. And that's where we interview some of the best major leaguers, current and former, and also people like yourselves and people in the industry. That's a fun one. And then, yeah, right now I'm just going and working with coaches from different sports and trying to help them build coaching effectiveness systems, whether it be individually or collectively as a group. But yeah, you can find me on Instagram, on Twitter at Justin Sua, JustinSua. And I try to be pretty consistent.
And very, very good content too. It's not just fluff. Like, I think you do a really good job of curating some awesome messages for folks. And, you know, I think this podcast was a good sample of a lot of that stuff. So thank you very much for taking the time to share your expertise and I think help a lot of people out. I know, to be honest, there's some processes that I'm looking at on my own that I need to go back and like, see if they check all the boxes from a systemization standpoint. So thank you for taking the time.
That's awesome. Thanks a lot. I appreciate you.
Thanks so much for tuning in to the CSP Elite Baseball Development Podcast. We really appreciate you carving out some time in your schedule to listen, not just to this episode, but also to some of the episodes from our archives. If you enjoy what you heard, we'd love it if you'd share it with friends, colleagues, and teammates, as well as leave us a review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Thanks again for your time.